When the city of Gulfport, Mississippi made plans to bulldoze a small African-American community, teacher-turned-advocate Derek Evans fought to stop it. Evans left his teaching job in Boston to return to his home, the Turkey Creek community. He worked to preserve the area settled by his ancestors, who were former slaves. His fight to preserve and protect the area are the subject of the film Come Hell or High Water. The film screens tonight at 6 o'clock at the UNC School of Public Health, and I'm joined by filmmaker Leah Mahan. Leah, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell us about Turkey Creek.
Well, I came to know about Turkey Creek through Derek. We were friends in Boston. We were interns working for filmmaker Henry Hampton on the Eyes on the Prize series. And so I knew Derek for years as a student and then a teacher in Boston, and always heard stories about Turkey Creek. And then he felt a great urgency around that time, 2001, when we went down there for the first time, because things were changing very rapidly, and a community that was founded by his ancestors after the Civil War was now surrounded by a sprawling city, and it looked like it might not be there much longer. He wanted to tell the story of that place and thought about writing a book, but invited me to come videotape and to record oral history. And at that time, we were just really trying to collect information about the past in order to try to preserve it for the future. And that's where the story began.
Well, and Derek describes some of the rich history of that area in the film.
The first four couples got together, and when slavery ended, they worked and saved up some money and traveled to the Mississippi Gulf Coast, which is where Turkey Creek is. And each one of those couples bought 80 acres of land, side by side with this meandering bayou that they named Turkey Creek because of the wild turkeys that were there. I come from two of those four couples.
When they settled here, they were the first ones here before Gulfport. There weren't anyone else. They worked this land over. They cleared it up because it was a wilderness.
Reverend Calvin H. Jackson Sr. and Derek Evans in the film Come Hell or High Water, which screens tonight at 6 o'clock UNC School of Public Health. And filmmaker Leah Mahan is with us. So you talked about things around it changing, and there was a cemetery involved, and all of this was up for some revitalization plans that also threatened the cemetery. Tell us more about that.
Right. Well, one of the things that spurred us to get down there quickly when we did was that the historic cemetery where the first settlers were buried had been partially destroyed. What had actually happened was the area was rezoned as a commercial area before residents knew it. It sort of went through the process, and all of a sudden this area that had always been the community cemetery was now a commercial zone. The caretaker, who's a character you see in the film, Dozier Hines, a landowner there, had been ill and went out to check on the cemetery and found all of the wooden markers, you know, that were not physical headstones, had been plowed under to make way for some commercial development. And that was really a wake-up call, obviously, to the older residents that lived there, that they could no longer live the way they had in a kind of self-sufficient, isolated way. They needed to get very involved in local government and start making themselves heard.
Well, here's Eva Skinner in your film and Counselor Kim Savant, who also in the film Come Hell or High Water, that screens tonight at the School of Public Health.
So it's probably a whole lot of bodies just all around here.
It's a lot of bodies where that building right there is. Ain't no telling how many hundred people was buried in.
And you said they had a lot of wooden markers.
That's right. Because my son had a wooden mark. Mm-hmm. And then the name was on it. My son was named Daniel.
If there's any cemetery paved over, then that's a total violation of our city ordinances. But I don't believe that happened.
Land records were very unclear, if I recall. As far as desecration of graves, you're telling me something I'd never heard before, and I really find that hard to believe.
So there we go. Derek Evans, Eva Skinner, Counselor Kim Savant. Savant, is that how he says his name?
Savant.
Savant. Mm-hmm. In the film Come Hell or High Water, Leah, the disconnect between the largely white community that was wanting to change this and the African-American community that inhabited that land is amazing. The sense of how they viewed Turkey Creek, it was as though they were in different states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Kim Savant says he wasn't even aware. He would drive through the community as a shortcut from one place to another, but he actually says it never occurred to him that there was a community there. And that invisibility, you know, can lead to a community being erased. And that's really part of what this story is about, is the power of telling your story and making yourself known so that these kinds of decisions can't be made.
If there's any doubt about the disconnect, I think here is Kim Savant again, Gulfport City Councilor, expressing his view about what should be done with that area, so how he sees Turkey Creek.
People have to decide whether Turkey Creek is a drainage channel or whether it is a scenic creek. Quite frankly, I don't think there's any way to decide but that it is a drainage channel.
There you go, Kim Savant, Gulfport City Councilor. So apparently he could not see this, a third possibility, that this was a community that had a history and people would feel very closely connected to that land.
Mm-hmm. And you hear in the film from Rose Johnson, who was baptized in the creek, it was a place, you know, people settled there because of the creek, because it was a rich natural area, because they could fish there and feed their families, and there was a real connection to the ecology of that place that was just invisible to people who were, you know, developing the city of Gulfport.
As you suggest, things were well underway in terms of development. How did the project to stop this kind of progress? How did that evolve?
Well, I mentioned Rose Johnson. She was working before Derek arrived and returned from Boston. She had begun working with the Sierra Club because the Sierra Club was trying to stop this big development in the wetlands. A developer named Butch Ward was going to fill a lot of land in order to build on 1,300 acres in the Turkey Creek watershed. And so she began working in alliance with the Sierra Club. Derek came into town and he helped to also get the Audubon Society and a lot of educators, people actually from the Mississippi Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. Part of what Derek's role was that he really built a lot of partnerships with people outside because the local authorities were not listening. And so national organizations and then ultimately the federal government got involved.
Well, Turkey Creek is in Mississippi, but the kinds of dramas that played out there play out all over the United States, even here in North Carolina. We'll look at one example in Mebane, North Carolina, where those kinds of partnerships, again, were constructed and reconstructed, and talk with one organizer in Mebane about the struggle to bring attention to historic communities and continue to talk about the film Come Hell or High Water on the state of things as our program continues. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about the intersection of environmental justice and community action. The struggles of one community, Turkey Creek, Mississippi, are the subject of a film, Come Hell or High Water. That film screens tonight at 6 at the UNC School of Public Health. A panel discussion follows. I'm joined by filmmaker Leah Mahan. And as we said, the struggles in the film are similar to those faced by members of communities here in North Carolina. One such community is the town of Mebane. Omega Wilson is the president of the West End Revitalization Association in Mebane, North Carolina, near Greensboro. And he led the fight for some basic amenities in that community. Omega, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Also joining us is Danielle Spurlock. She's a professor of city and regional planning at UNC Chapel Hill. She advises communities on environmental justice issues. Danielle, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
So, Omega Wilson, let me start with you and what was going on in Mebane. What has Turkey Creek got to do with Mebane? Where are the parallels, or are there?
There are parallels. One, there's a family parallel. My wife and I, Brenda, we raised three sons there for 10 years. In fact, two of them, twins, were Ayanna Morey, Kojo's the oldest, were born in Mississippi. We never actually went to Turkey Creek. We went to Gulfport and the coastal area many times over that 10-year period of time. The other connection is that many of the things that Leah has identified, and that's in the film, Come Hell or High Water, are parallel to our community, where we're only 30 miles from this studio in Alamance County. Mebane is part Alamance and part Orange County, the city limits, where an interstate highway was planned by the city of Mebane, city council, county commissioners for Alamance County, and the North Carolina Department of Transportation to build a highway corridor, eight lanes. The initial construction was going to be four lanes. The first 4 miles would basically eliminate the West End community, traditional African-American community with burial grounds, again, cemetery that dates all the way back into slavery, with headstones that show people were born as slaves and died free in that local community. And another community just north of Mebane, which is called White Level, and that community was settled by people who are now referred to as African American, some mulatto, but actually they were to settle out Native Americans who refused to move, and they became a part of the community. And that highway corridor was designed to eliminate most or all of those two communities without compensation. Churches, cemeteries, and the process of planning took place for several years.
Over what period? Give us a time frame. Now, when did this happen?
Well, we filed a complaint in 1999, but the process for planning had already taken place and had already been signed off on by the city council, county commissioners, and the state.
Well, I'd like to stop you right there, because 1999, that's a rough point, right, at that point in time. That follows by decades. The infamous Highway 147 that runs right through Durham. It crushed the Hayti Black Wall Street. It was a traumatic event that is still remembered in this town. And there was fallout from that. It was so traumatic that the state of North Carolina made a pledge. And I want to point that out at this point and have you finish the story, because decades later, apparently, the pledge was forgotten. But do finish that story for me.
Well, we knew about the pledge, but we didn't think we would.
And what was it?
The pledge is they wouldn't do it again.
Yeah.
The Department of Transportation was taking to the federal level, and courts and EPA at the federal level and the Department of Transportation said they would not, quote-unquote, make this mistake again to build a highway corridor, plan a highway corridor that would decimate a historic community without compensation, cultural concerns, planning concerns, et cetera. But they did, and our community became a, quote-unquote, another West End because there's a West End in the Hayti area that was going to be impacted that had dirt streets, poor water and sewer, poor access, houses that were substandard. So the identifying markers were exactly the same as the West End in Mebane. And in our case, we filed a complaint in 1999 just to participate in the process, and we could not get a response from state officials, city officials, county officials, even though we physically came to the state legislature in Raleigh. So we can file a complaint. After 4 years of trying, we filed a complaint in 1999. Department of Justice said to us that your situation is not just a highway. You're dealing with a historic pattern of discrimination that relates to the denial of basic amenities. And we said, wait, we're just talking about the highway. They said, no. Based on what you've described to us, you've been denied paved streets. You've been denied safe water and sewer. You have outhouses in the city. You have dead-end streets. You have areas where school buses can't turn around. You don't have sidewalks. You have substandard power lines. And the list went on. There was about 17 major things that we had paid taxes for, but we were not getting.
And I have to stop you there again, because this again follows a pattern. One of the things you do is if you deny services and you make the place look like it's not quite up to the rest of the city, then you go back and say, well, that place is, how did Mr. Savant describe it? It's either a drainage ditch, because you systematically left it a drainage ditch. You can do the same with education. You underfund education long enough, call it broken, and then say, maybe we should privatize education. That'll fix the system that, by the way, we broke by neglect. This is the pattern that they're talking about, right?
This is the pattern that they're talking about, except in our case, what was going to be done with the highway, we didn't understand initially. They said we're going to build a four-mile highway to get from one side of Mebane to another. Mebane was under 10,000 residents. So I was, well, why are you going to build a highway this big in such a small area? And after we investigated, we found out it was going to be an interstate corridor to Danville, Virginia, and it's still planned. And along that corridor in the immediate area of our community, and some of the land was going to be used to build an industrial park and distribution center. All total combined, it was going to be over 2,600 acres. It would be one of the largest distribution centers and manufacturing centers, parks as they call them, in the eastern part of the United States. And it was all planned without public input for over 15 years. And the reason our area was chosen was because we were told by engineers with the Department of Transportation that we were least likely to complain. We were least likely to fight it. We were least likely to be informed about how to address the issue. So they thought it would be basically a done deal or something pretty easy to do.
Danielle Spurlock, let's take a step back and see how it is that a state and a locality cannot recognize a few decades after the fact that they are doing it again. What are the factors that sort of blind us or blind state and public policymakers to the fact that they're doing it again?
I think in the end, it becomes this argument around economic development. You see it in the film over and over again. They come to a public meeting and they're saying, well, don't you want jobs? Don't you want to be able to send your children to school? It's talking about all these benefits that no one's going to say no to. Of course I want a job. Yes, I'd like to be able to build my wealth. But they're not ever asking the question, but what are we asking you to give up? When we talk about Turkey Creek, part of the reason they're located in this area is because this land was not desirable for other uses to other people. This is what's available to those who have been enslaved and are coming out of slavery. This is the land they can purchase. It's allowing sustenance fishing. It has a lot of attributes, but it's also undesirable for other reasons, being close to the swampland and the disease vectors that often come out of that. The shift in time, suddenly it's prime real estate. And we're talking about having this. It changes the argument to saying, well, this neighborhood that I didn't even know existed is suddenly blocking this larger structure, the growth that drives our urban areas. And how can you say no to that growth? And when we just focus on the economic development, the economic growth, that's how we can continue to repeat those problems of marginalized populations and shifting, in many cases, environmental protection to the side as well.
So Omega Wilson, when that happened and they made those arguments, how did you fight? But what do you say to that?
Well, what we did in 1999 when we filed a federal complaint, Department of Justice said the state of North Carolina, the city of Mebane, are violating constitutional laws that are in place, and they identified them as rights to basic amenities. They're denying you access to basic amenities for which you paid, that I mentioned earlier. And the Department of Justice contacted the United States Department of Transportation. The secretary at that time was the first African-American secretary of the United States Department of Transportation. His name is Rodney Slater. He wrote a letter directing the state of North Carolina's Department of Transportation to comply with the law. In fact, they flew an officer to North Carolina to meet in February of 1999, 2 weeks after we filed a complaint. It was very quick to back off because they were violating constitutional law, and the project was going to be funded, the highway was going to be funded by federal money. So the United States Department of Transportation, at the direction of the Department of Justice, was withholding $20-some million dollars to start the project. And that's what happened. As a result of that visibility, the United States Department of Environment Protection Agency contacted us and wanted us to participate in the environmental justice program. We didn't have any idea what they were talking about. The Environment Protection Agency has a program called Environmental Justice at the federal level. And they deal with issues related to water, sewer, air quality, and human exposure for public health concerns. And since the communities that were going to be destroyed in our area still had sewage running in their side ditches, they had failed septic tanks, some streets 100%, You had dead-end streets with dust that children walked on. It causes air problems, asthma, other kinds of health issues. That EPA had a responsibility that they had overlooked, quote-unquote, I'll say overlooked. So when we file a complaint, the Department of Justice asked them to get involved in it and do the part that they had been overlooking for decades. So I was called to Washington, D.C. to be a part of a plan to make recommendations about how the federal government should look at these issues for environmental justice, water, sewer issues for the whole country, to be an advisor for EPA and thus provide recommendations to the Council for Environmental Quality at the president's cabinet level. I did that for 4 years.
Well, Leah Mahan, I don't want to leave Turkey Creek just yet. When those questions of economic development came up there and resistance was building, how were they handled? How did they meet those challenges?
Well, I think, you know, Derek would be the first to say that we're not against economic development, as Danielle said. Part of what they did was the city of Gulfport had developed a 25-year plan for the growth of the city that did not really even acknowledge that Turkey Creek existed. The historic sites in Turkey Creek were not there. The creek was not really acknowledged as an environmental resource. And so they created their own plan for the revitalization of Turkey Creek with the help, a lot of it came into being after Katrina. An urban design firm did incredible pro bono work, developing a plan that could both improve the community, you know, without displacing it, in the context of a growing city, and finding, you know, ways to do that without paving it over.
So, Omega, when you have given advice at the federal level, it's on the president's desk. It seems that so much of that advice would have to do with paying attention to the context, listening to people at the neighborhood level, so that you can create a template. But that template has to include get into the neighborhood and listen. Am I right about that?
You're exactly right. As a matter of fact, we updated our complaint this past September, and the EPA is coming in to review the location of the overpass. There's a huge overpass for 119 that would be less than a quarter of a mile from my office where my wife and I live. It goes through West End to review to determine whether or not it's a Superfund site, because the state of North Carolina planned to put the overpass, anchor it into a closed furniture factory that dates back almost 100 years, mm-hmm. All kinds of chemicals, all kinds of underground storage tanks, petroleum. For Craftique is the name of the furniture. It was owned by Pulaski Furniture out of Virginia. So there are all kinds of chemicals there on acres and acres, old buildings that have not been dissembled. The water hasn't been tested. Underground tanks, all the chemical contamination in the ground has not been removed. And the Department of Transportation, quote unquote, failed to put that in their environmental impact statement that they worked on for years. So EPA is coming in this year to address that issue that has been on the table for Department of Transportation for decades. And for some reason, community people knew about the impact, but the Department of Transportation seemed not to be aware.
Well, Danielle Spurlock, we've heard a tiny fraction of the effort it takes to bring environmental justice on the big scale. I mean, are our communities in any position to call attention to and then take on the legal fight? How do they do this?
They do it with community groups that have enormous commitment to addressing this issue. North Carolina is the birthplace of environmental justice. So it is the Warren County PCB landfill. It is Dolly Burwell and so many unnamed people who laid in front of the trucks, those who put in so much of their time. This is after I've worked my job or my second job, putting in the additional time to organize, to go to meetings, to work so hard. That's the heart of it. So I think it's, and the willingness, I think I've always been in awe of the communities that will work over decades. When I first met Ms. Burwell, it was 25 years in We're asking people to fight for decades to have clean environments. So that's where it begins. Part of the work that I do with the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network is to then support communities as they're doing this organizing. Folks like Naima Mohammed and Saladin Mohammed do a lot of the community organizing. Folks out of the School of Public Health will help us with some of the, like Steve Wing, will help us with some of the health indicators.
I wish we had more time to tell this decades-long struggle, but I want to thank all of you for at least giving us this piece of it. Danielle Spurlock, Professor of City and Regional Planning at UNC Chapel Hill. Omega Wilson, President of the West End Revitalization Association in Mebane. And Leah Mahan is a filmmaker of Come Hell or High Water. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you
for inviting us.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things. The film will screen tonight, 6 o'clock, UNC School of Public Health. More information at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.